Welcome to Alchemical Dialogues, an Amber Light podcast. Join Dr. Henry Critella and Don Londorf for their discussion on multidimensional healing, accessing the human matrix. The information provided on this website and these podcasts is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this website and in these podcasts is intended to be a substitute for medical, health, therapeutic, diagnosis, or treatment. The opinions expressed by the guests in these podcasts are not necessarily the opinions of Amber Light International and anyone associated with this organization.
Welcome, everyone. And thank you, Don, for agreeing to do this.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
For everyone else who's listening and here on the live recording, Donald and I met, I can't remember. When did we do the Qigong training? Was that in the 90s or was it in the 2000s?
It'd be late 90s, early 2000s.
I had an interest in Qigong, and somebody had also mentioned your name to me. And part of what attracted me is that you were an MD, even though you weren't practicing allopathic medicine anymore. But being a physician, that just, I knew what you had been through. And I was also at a point of changing and thinking about doing different things. And so I wanted to get to know you. And then we did the Qigong training together, an introductory and an advanced one. And then we did some work together. You treated me with acupuncture for a while. And then we did a couple of shamanic sessions, a recent one just a few weeks ago. It's been a pleasure to get to know you, and I'm so thankful you're willing to do this. For the group here, when Don and I were talking, I really love the way you put it, that you think of healing on a continuum. But more than that, it's kind of a map we can follow to explore all the dimensions of health. And you emphasized in our conversation that that multidimensionality is really the hallmark of being a human being. I'm thrilled to explore this map with you a little more. A little more about you. You graduated from McGill University Medical School, and Canada is certainly on a high list right now for most Americans. So it gives you even more credibility. You were born in the States?
No, actually, I was born in Montreal.
Montreal. So,
and raised in Montreal.
You have dual citizenship?
Still do. Yeah. That's probably need to renew my Canadian passport.
Yeah. Another reason I really like you, and I'm glad you're my friend. So, you received the Campbell Howard Prize in Clinical Medicine and then came to the States, did your residency in emergency medicine at Emory in Atlanta and a fellowship in emergency medicine back at McGill. Practiced and taught at various medical centers, taught emergency medicine. And then in 1996, you opened your Chinese medicine practice in Pittsburgh, here where we live, right?
Yeah.
And you received your acupuncture and Chinese medicine training from Nanjing University of Traditional Chinese Medicine. You're certified in acupuncture from the National Certification Commission for Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine. You studied with Grandmaster Shi and became a certified Qigong therapist and second level Qigong master. You said you practiced meditation since the age of 12, and you've also trained in Peruvian Andean shamanic medicine. So with that being said, that's quite a, that's quite a map you follow.
In a nutshell.
Yeah, but in a nutshell. Can you talk a little bit about the map you followed? How did you find your way in that particular way?
My parents, my dad is probably a little bit more traditional. You know, he's not so much, even as I went into energy medicine later on in my career, that probably wasn't like his greatest wish for me as a son, but he kind of came to grow into it a little bit more as I went through and he realized I wouldn't be on the street practicing what I practice. My mom, on the other hand, was always a little bit more open to maybe a little bit more of the occult or things that were a little different. So she's the one who took me to a meditation center when I was 12. So I learned TM, Transcendental Meditation. That was my first foray in meditation. And I took to it quite well. I mean, I did it for many years until it didn't suit my needs. And then I started exploring different systems of meditation. So even as I went through medical school and learned more of the traditional way of doing medicine. I knew there were areas that were not covered very well in Western medicine. There were definitely some areas that lacked, and, you know, especially in the spiritual dimension. So I kept an open mind as I went through my internship residency and, you know, did my usual path in terms of my specialty. And as I went through my first job, I was in, after my residency, I was in Vancouver in British Columbia. And I met up with a kind of an interesting character. He's a ninja master of the old school, difficult to find, but I had a particular security need at that time that led me to find him. And then we became friends and we opened a school together. But he was also the one who introduced me to more of the concept of energy healing. So rather than just doing the destructive part of martial arts, he kind of introduced me to the landscape of energy medicine, how to use your hands for healing. My first integrative medicine modalities at that time, mostly using some liniments for trauma, those kind of things. But that opened up a whole different dimension. So by the time I was ready to leave the West Coast and come east, I decided I would write to different Qigong masters around the country and see what they had to offer. In those days, you had to write, you had to find their names in magazines. It wasn't on the internet where everybody is there. So it was a little bit more of a different path. But I found Grandmaster Shi in Kingston, New York. So by the time I got my last job in emergency, which was at Strong Memorial in Rochester, I decided that I would study with him. And through circumstances that are rather interesting and probably a little bit more fate related, University of Rochester messed up my immigration so bad that I wasn't able to practice emergency medicine when I moved here. So now I had an academic 9-to-5 job that allowed me to travel weekends to study Qigong. So I, for a very long time, I was going a weekend a month to study with Grandmaster Shi and fell even more in love with energy medicine. So that landscape evolved over time. It wasn't like I suddenly decided I didn't want to do Western medicine. It was more of an evolution of reaching a certain stage in my life where how medicine and healing was being done in a traditional sense or in the Western sense was not making me very happy. So I started exploring that aspect a little bit more. And eventually I started having a little bit of side practice, even while I was still working in emergency at the hospital. I had a little energy medicine practice, just using my hands and nothing else, no needles, no herbs, and really fell even more in love with that. So by the time I was really ready to make a jump, I decided to leave. So that progression has been a lifetime progression. I don't think it was a, you know, all of a sudden I was unhappy with Western medicine. I think there are some wonderful things about it, but the landscape, the map that they use is I think a little too limited for my liking.
Can you say a little more about falling more in love with energy medicine?
It's like having black and white TV and all of a sudden discovering that you can actually have a color TV. That extra sense that you have when you're using, connecting with the energetic field, as opposed to treating everything on a very literal level, which is, you know, the physical level in terms of cells and things that you can touch and measure. Now you have an enhanced area that you can actually interact with people and people respond. I mean, obviously nothing works for everybody. For those who are attracted to energy medicine, it has a really lovely, interactive, very intimate spectrum of healing that can actually reach very deep levels.
You also trained in the use of herbs.
I did. For me, my program was an interesting program. It was a combined herbal and acupuncture program. Even though it was a Chinese program, I did most of my learning here in the United States. The professor came from China to live with my Qigong grandmaster. They must have owed him an immense debt of gratitude for them to allow one of their top professors to come to the United States, live here. I think he was here for a year and a half or so. We did all these intensive sessions with him to get all the hours in. And then eventually we went to China to do our practical. So the combination of the herbs and acupuncture, really every system of Chinese medicine can stand alone. So whether you're doing acupuncture, Chinese herbs, Tui Na, which is like a doctorate cross of chiropractic and massage, or even some of the energetic medicine can stand alone, but they're best weaved together. And that's kind of where that multidimensional approach to health is really very valuable, because you're not just using one lane. You know, you have a four-lane highway of things that you can actually interact with, and you can weave them together. So if you understand how everything relates, you can really get layered healing and, you know, accessing so many different parts of the psyche and the body.
So that understanding of the interrelationships that came with experience?
It does. I don't think it's difficult to teach that. I think you have to have an experience. And I think most things that relate to integrative medicine need to be experienced. And Chinese medicine is a very experiential form of medicine. I mean, if you've never had acupuncture and all of a sudden you have a session and all of a sudden and you realize that you're feeling different things and things are moving in your body and you're connecting with different parts of your body, you have your own personal experience of healing as opposed to your Western doctor who says, here, take this Zantac prescription and you know your GERD will go away. It's like, you'll have to wait until to see if that happens, but there's nothing really engaging about that particular form of medicine. So when you're doing prescriptions and scripts and really very quick visits, it's very limiting. But when you have your own experience of what is shifting in your body and different awarenesses and different insights, you know, that's where the magic happens. I had one of my clients today, you know, came in and said, you know, after my session, I realized that when my dad left, when I was very young, then my digestive issues started happening, you know, and then she connected those pieces together. So I'm excited for her because now with awareness comes, you know, the ability to move, you know, big pieces of your healing. It's about connection. So if you don't have the connection, it's, you know, it's very clinical, it's very cold, and that is not the highest reach of medicine. It is not medicine of the highest order if you're just doing physical healing.
So psychiatry, my field, gets into that a little bit. And I know there's a new discipline of somatopsychotherapy where you really focus on feelings in the body and using your body. And there's been a long history in Western psychiatry of psychosomatic medicine. They've called it different things over time, depending on the politics. But really, that it's where things are localized in the body and the interrelationship. And in Rochester, where I trained in psychiatry, its claim to fame was biopsychosocial medicine. And I remember I didn't have much interaction with George Engel, who was the father of that. George Engel was an internist who trained as a psychoanalyst. Mm. And he was very convinced that the reason people would talk to him is because he was not trained as a psychiatrist, which always struck me funny. But he was very proud of that. He'd say, I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm an internist and a Freudian psychoanalyst. Mm-hmm. And I remember one lecture he gave, he said, you know, the problem is not that psychiatry is not medical enough. The problem is that medicine is not psychosocial enough. And he just insisted on looking. He didn't include the spiritual dimension. That was probably a big no-no back in those days. But he was very insistent that it's a holistic approach. You just can't separate the body from the mind, from the heart. And so that was, and that's still Rochester's claim to fame. There's a resurgence of that. I don't know if they've added the spiritual part. I know in psychiatry, before I retired, there was more talk about the importance of spirituality and including that. But psychiatry, you know, it's so bureaucratic. They were so worried that we would begin to proselytize and try to convert people that it felt like the most we could really do is ask somebody if religion or spirituality was important to them and what particular religion did they follow and tried to clue into that. But there were all these things that I felt as a restriction against a real interaction and conversation about that. Mm-hmm. In a meaningful way. At least in, I don't know about the rest of medicine, but at least in psychiatry, there have been forays getting closer and closer to looking at things more holistically. And now we're back to trying to make everything genetic and
everything's a cell.
Yeah, everything has to be biological again and quick and dirty and checklists instead of really, really talking to people. And
it's indicative of where we are. A people as a nation, I mean, we're really, it's almost like we're afraid of our own spirituality, you know, at least when it gets to like the nuts and bolts and really engaging it on a level other than personally or, you know, in a religious setting. I think once you kind of start bringing that into corporations and institutions, you know, the barriers tend to kind of come up quite a bit. I remember having a discussion years ago. I was on the review panel for one of our textbooks, and I had this discussion with the, you know, this is a very accomplished emergency physician, professor, textbook author, 3 volumes. You know, this is the top of the game in my field. And I said, you know, we really don't have a definition of what healing is, apart from wound healing. I mean, that's the only thing you could find in these 3 volumes of giant books. And he's just looking at me as like I have 3 heads. He's like, well, why do we need that? I mean, why do we want that? I mean, so there was no need to know what healing was about or what health was about. It was really just about interventions and, you know, how do you save people's lives or at least, you know, mitigate their symptoms. So it was just a really interesting conversation. But I've hit that level with so many people in the medical profession. It's just like that spiritual part is makes people very uncomfortable.
It does. I don't know if this is still true, but years ago when I was practicing, every few years they would come out with the major textbook in psychiatry. It's Friedman and Kaplan's comprehensive textbook of like psychiatry. It's I think it's still only two volumes. One of the revisions, the new editions, this is decades ago. I'm flipping through and I look at the history of psychiatry and I was shocked. They included Ken Wilber, who's a self-made philosopher, who I had started to read. And I can't remember the other people. There were some other people who really shocked me. And I'm thinking, this is really progress. And then the new edition came out years later and they're gone. They disappeared. So I think psychiatry thought they had gone too far or something.
Well, they tried it. Good for them.
Well, for a while, I don't know. They must have gotten some pretty bad feedback.
Possibly.
Well, no, they probably did. They probably had, who knows. I did some training in past life regression therapy with Brian Weiss. You know, it was pretty intensive, but it was only over a week. But the way he presented it, and I think really, it's pretty safe. And there's no reports of anything. There's a few things you have to be careful of. Usually anxiety reactions when things start to release. And it was a pretty good training and he was really promoting it. I went to that training, it was at Omega, and I had been reading about past life regression and I was curious. The reason I went is that Brian Weiss is an MD and I was struggling and thinking and wondering. So I go and it's a, whatever, 100 people or more, you know, room full of people, handful of men, almost all women. I might've been the only physician. There might've been another one, but I'm the only one I remember. And most of them were body workers. And one of them was brave enough to stand up and say, the reason I'm here is because I'm a physical therapist and I'm working with these patients who have contractures and I'm exercising their limbs to release the contractures. And they come out with these feelings and memories. I don't know where it's coming from. I don't know what to do with them. And it's bizarre. I don't know. So that was one experience. And then a little bit like I did with you when we took you out to lunch, or maybe you took me out to lunch, and I asked you, how'd you make this jump? And I went to Brian one-on-one. And it was really funny because I imagine, I don't know if any of you have met Brian Weiss. In my fantasy, I thought he was going to be this big, blustering, I don't know what, right? He's a thin, mild-mannered, for the Sufis in the group here, very effaced guy, soft-spoken. His faculty was talking louder than he was. So I go up to him one-on-one, and I look at him, and I said, how did you do it? And he said, what do you mean? I said, how did you put this into your psychiatric practice? He was still practicing as a psychiatrist. I think I said, how did you do it and why did you do it? I think I said, how? And anyways, he said, interestingly enough, I was expecting a lecture of some sort. You know me, I want information. He said, with all seriousness, I couldn't stand it anymore. Mm-hmm. And I said, what? And he brought tears to my eyes. He said, he was running a psychopharmacology department. It sounded so much like me. I mean, I wasn't running a psychopharm department, but I was using a lot of medicines with kids. I was really well known in Rochester for that. And I did a lot of good work. He said, I'm running the psychopharmacology department, but I have this other technique that is safer and really powerful. And I just couldn't stand it anymore. I wasn't promoting that. I just couldn't do it anymore. What else could I ask him? I just said, thank you. And then it's like, wow, you know? And then when I met you, I remembered that. I did a little bit of work with Herb Benson. Mm-hmm. I didn't study intensively with him. I took a Cape Cod week-long workshop where he got to play most of the time. But his story was the same story. You know, he's Harvard trained and he's starting off in his practice. And cardiologists make their money treating high blood pressure. So he's a new graduate. He wants to be a researcher. He's in the Harvard system. And he's the one, and I never knew this, he discovered the white coat phenomenon. He said, the nurses would see the patients first, take their blood pressure. I would come in, take their blood pressure, and it was always higher. I just got curious. So he said, back in those days, we didn't have ethical review boards. So I just pulled in all these medical students and I kept on taking their blood pressure. You know, it wasn't dangerous or anything. And he said, I figured out it was anxiety. So he gave a grand rounds. He did a little more work, I think. And he gave a grand rounds about what he was finding. And he said, in the middle of his talk, his colleagues in their white coats got up and walked out. So he went to the dean at Harvard, and much to my surprise, he said to the dean, I think I'm ruining my career. This is what I want to study, but look at what's happening. What's your advice? And the dean said, this is Harvard. You can do whatever you want. And so I met him when he was older, just before he was retiring. He brought faculty with him, and one of his faculty said, you heard that story about people getting up and walking out? They still do it.
Wow. Wow.
The dedication and courage of people like Brian Weiss, you, Herb Benson, Jim Gordon, who I did train with intensively, he's a psychiatrist. I don't know if he ever drank the psychiatry Kool-Aid, to tell you the truth. He was always doing his thing. And then the curiosity, I mean, we started talking about the map. When I talked to Jim Gordon, his story was he got hurt. He got a back injury. And allopathic medicine gave up on him. And he said, I would walk in and I knew what they were thinking. They were calling me a turkey. And he met an energy practitioner who I think gave him some herbs. He vomited for 3 days. Checked in. The person said, yeah, you have to keep going. And within months, he was playing golf. Hmm. And that was it. He just said, I needed to find out what the heck was going on. He just couldn't stop himself. Like it sounds like to me, you couldn't stop yourself. Herb Benson couldn't stop himself, right? Brian couldn't stop himself.
I think once you wake up to the fact that your way of thinking or your way of helping people is still black and white, and there's like a beautiful world of color out there. Once you kind of make that jump, it's hard to go back to black and white TV. You know, once you've expanded to that colorful, rich, dense map of humanity, there's no going back. I mean, you're going to be perpetually unhappy if you keep wanting to go back or you keep being set back to that black and white, you know, unidimensional world. Once you've walked into that different landscape of healing, it's soul sucking to kind of go back to that environment where there's really no growth. There's not even like a perception that it needs to grow. People are just in that system, you know, walking along and just happy to kind of walking along the river, but they never get across the river. They never get to swim in a different environment. But once you get to taste of that, it's difficult. You can't put that genie back in the bottle. You know, once that genie is out, it is out and it's playing and it's expanding, and you either follow or you might actually get sick or you get very depressed because now you're not following your soul's calling, and that soul is calling you from that depth. You have to answer. You know, you cannot ignore it. The story of me coming to Rochester was, you know, whenever I had reached that part of my career where I was on the West Coast, I was living in Vancouver, I was on the seawall, I could walk to the beach. You know, I was working in a beautiful hospital, talented staff, modern, you know, everything that I was well paid. I'd achieved everything that I'd set out when I was younger in my career. But every time I would meditate, that little voice inside would say, it's time to go. And of course, I would ignore that because I'm an a very good place, and I'm loving this job, and I'm rewarded and respected, and you know, everything that goes along with it. But for years, I ignored it. And then at some point, you have to decide not to ignore those inner callings. And that kind of led me to Rochester. So once, you know, once you get that perception that there's something bigger, you need to go explore that bigger. I mean, you can't stay in that small box that you've lived in. So I think all those physicians that have made that jump probably went through that same experience where there's so much more to healing than what we learn in whatever number of years your medical program is, 4 or 5 years. You know, what we know is this big. The rest of my room is what we don't know. And to just say that this little piece here is sufficient for our needs in terms of healing, in terms of human beings, in terms of taking care of people, it's completely inadequate. And when you wake up to that realization, then there's no going back. I mean, I think you have to honor that and do something else. When I was still in a hospital in 1995, I remember I phoned the NIH. I said, I want to do research. And I want to put, you know, do a before and after MRIs or PET scans of people, before and after energy medicine. There was a lengthy pause at the end of that. Now it's a kind of a cool concept today. But back then it was like, no, we fund pain research, we fund cancer research, we fund one other thing. It was like three big things, but what I was asking was really too much. You know, just like somebody in Harvard wanting to study, you know, the effects of anxiety on blood pressure and your colleagues walking out, it's the same thing. I mean, you cannot be in a research center and want to do something completely out of the box and be shut down. That's why I had to leave. I mean, there was no way I was going to be able to do that.
Before we open it up to questions, I'd like you to continue your map and talk about how you got into Peruvian shamanism.
The shamanism came later. As I had studied with my Qigong grandmaster almost 20 years, and towards the later years, it was clear that there was more to be learned, but he had either reached the end of what he could teach me, or he had reached the end of what he wanted to teach me. I never quite figured that one out. I mean, sometimes difficult with Asian masters is just that there's a little bit of a lost in translation part and the cultural difficulty that is ever present. I decided that I would send it out to the universe. So when I meditated every night, I'd say, I need a new teacher. And I would nag. You know, I did that really very intensely for a month or two every night for, you know, half an hour. And it's like, I need a new teacher. This is what I need. And I was very specific until a time came where I said, enough. You know, that little voice inside that says, speaks very loudly that you know, enough, stop asking, you know, we're on it. But soon afterwards, I discovered the shamanic path. And that was kind of a lovely segue. What the shamanic work gave me that Qigong and Chinese medicine could not give me of the map is an expanded mythic and almost archetypical part of the map, where there are images and energies and a much richer landscape. Previous one was actually pretty decent, but what this one gave me was a very expanded upper and lower world and many places to travel kind of map for healing. And so I started studying with the Peruvian shamans, who were just very giving. There's really no holdbacks from them. They really kind of explained it as best as they understood it and let you run with it. So it was a really lovely tradition. It's all about the light. It's all about removing the heavy energy in your energetic field and exchanging that for light. So it's a very sweet, loving, I mean, there's obviously the darker side of sorcery that's also the flip side of that in South America, but from the shamanic tradition, it was really a wonderful, very practical way of engaging the energetic field. So that allowed me to do soul retrievals. We can do destiny retrievals. Time becomes a circular map that's expanded in terms of the healing landscape. So your emotion, it doesn't really matter if it's a spiritual issue, an emotional issue, intellectual issue, physical issue, or even a genetic issue. I mean, there are ways of engaging the energetic body to see if we can actually access some of these patterns and create the shifts that are there. And it's very empowering for people because they have their own experience of what's happening. So the shamanic work was really just an upgrade of the map, if you will.
And you trained in Peru and you also trained in the States, right?
I studied with Alberto Villaldo. If you've never read anything on shamanism, his book, Shaman, Healer, Sage is lovely. It's a really great, very approachable book. As soon as I did my first seminar, I signed up for the 2-year, in those days it was a 2-year training. And went through that training, and then we met different shamans during our travels, and then eventually we just started studying from the shamans in Peru directly. We would hire them on our trips as our guides, and they'd take us through, you know, lesser travel places and ruins and altitudes and different places and going through ceremonies and rituals. So it just became a more interactive way of learning.
You introduced me to the work, part of the work you had done with Alberto Villalba, and the part that I'm continuing to do fits with the spiritual. I'm not doing hands-on healing one-on-one with people, but the visualizations and bringing in something new and moving energy, that's really powerful. And that's something that a group of us is starting to study again in Rochester, like I told you when we had the conversation. But I wanted to share with people that I don't think you told me you were studying. I think we were doing acupuncture. It was kind of like maintenance acupuncture. I didn't have a big problem. And I had studied Qigong with you, and I wanted to experience more about energy flow, and you thought I would feel it better that way. And something had happened. I had had an interaction with somebody that was really unpleasant. And I remember talking to you about it, because things like that tend to get under my skin. I'm affected by rejection more than I want to admit sometimes. But this seemed different. I can't remember exactly how I described it to you. And I thought you were going to help release energy with acupuncture. And you said, no, I think there's another way. And it was a shamanic approach. So we did it in your office. And what I remember is there was a change like almost overnight. And so I kind of, you know, put that in the back of my mind. And then when you offered the training to initiate into Muneki, the tradition that Villalba brought, I jumped at that. And, you know, I did the practices for a while and integrated it with my Sufi practices. And then it kind of fell off a little bit, well, fell off a lot. But something happened recently, and it was much more intense than years ago. But that same feeling, like, I can't, there's something I just can't get rid of. So we talked, and you invited me, and you did a shamanic session. And I'm just relating to people, there was a change overnight. So me being me, I of course said, well, you know, that's a placebo effect. So 2 weeks later, I'm talking to Don about the podcast, and I say, you know, it is a lot better. And here it is weeks after that, and it's still a lot better. And getting a little long for a placebo effect. Part of it is I didn't feel, well, on the table, this time, the second time you had me on the table, my eyes closed and you were shaking rattles and doing other things. The part that almost made me laugh is I'm just laying on the table and I start getting a little uncomfortable, and I felt it in my right shoulder. You know, like a little crick just from laying still. And he's at my left shoulder, and I know I didn't move. And he says, oh yeah, you have something in your shoulder. And I say, yeah, my right shoulder. And by the way, how did you know? And he just laughed at me very, very kindly. And he's shaking his rattle. And then he did it again. There was something, it was the small of my back or something. And he said, oh, there's a cord there. And that he had to cut that. I don't know if you remember this. I don't know if I told you after the session or before that when I was really going through a struggle, way before I recontacted you, I was saying to somebody, trying to explain how I felt in this struggle I felt. And what I said was, I feel like there's a cobra around me constricting me and I can't breathe. And when I said it, I stopped myself and said, where the hell did that come from? I don't use imagery like that. I mean, I do now, but I didn't back then. And I just always remembered that. And I don't know if you remember me telling you that. Was that before or after or both?
I don't remember the timing of that. I mean, okay. But that's kind of what I was talking about. The part of the landscape is there are archetypes and there are some imagery, and you know, to not second guess them, but to engage them directly, you know, is a little bit of where some of that magic resides. That really powerful way, just like sacred drama can be an amazing way for people to engage their life experience, their spirituality. You know, I've had like amazing insights during that process, being self-conscious of it, obviously, when you started. But when you connect with that little kernel of something that you need to connect with, is an incredible, powerful thing. Probably one of the more difficult things with the shamanic work is to really not second guess. So when I do like a soul retrieval, for instance, where we, a lot of rattling, but, you know, basically journeying for somebody to explore their inner landscape, which is typically a little bit more of their past, and then finding parts of their energy body that have fractured that you're returning. Some of the imagery is really crazy. I mean, I brought back a little piece of pottery that I found down there. And I said, I'm kind of embarrassed to say this, but I got this little piece of pottery and they started crying and it was so meaningful for them. But, you know, for me, it was just like a little piece of pottery. I didn't know what it meant. So not second guessing what you find and what you connect with and just really engaging it at face value is something that, you know, everybody has to learn along the way, because it's as our intellect tends to kind of analyze these things. And it's like, nah, that doesn't make sense. But every time I kind of put that aside and say, okay, here's what I brought back and this is what I saw, it's always something that's relevant for the person. It may not be relevant for me, but it's not about me.
Yeah. And I really appreciate about that with you, because it would not be hard for me to get into analyzing everything. That's just my nature. And your style is to help me just get through that. So we really kind of sped along, and that was really a wonderful learning experience. So I want to open it up. Do people have comments or questions?
Yeah, so I just love how you integrate the shamanism and all the other things that you know. What you do mainly, is it Chinese medicine, or, and then you just integrate the other things in, or do you just look at somebody and go, oh, they need this?
It's a little bit of both. My main practice is, as advertised, acupuncture and Chinese herbology, and that is the brochure advertising for the practice. The shamanic work I do not advertise. So either people find me because they've met somebody and my name came up, or if it's in my practice, it'll be like what Henry mentioned before, we're having a discussion and it starts to veer in a direction where we're really out in a different part of the map. When people say, I've had this trauma, I can't let go of it, I've tried everything, it doesn't move, it doesn't want to go, you know, something's stuck, or somebody comes in, it's like, well, I feel like there's something attached to me, if we're like talking about entities. So these little mini exorcism type things are not things that I would do with my standard practice. So, you know, I will approach the subject gently and kind of probe a little bit and see if that's something that's doable for most people. But usually by the time people bring it something like that up, then it's we tend to kind of go in the shamanic direction. You know, the interesting thing about Chinese medicine, I don't know if people know this, is its roots are shamanic. When you look at traditional Chinese medicine, TCM, as we know it today, that was the kind of sterilized version of Chinese medicine that came out of communist China when the imperial times of China, you know, changed over to the People's Republic. They really were not keen, just like our Western medicine, you know, they weren't keen on all these spiritual concepts and ghost points and all these other concepts that were part of traditional Chinese medicine or ancient Chinese medicine. But when you look back at the history of Chinese medicine thousands of years ago, it is very much shamanic in origin. You know, that we have an historical character who probably maybe have been a real character, Shen Nong, who apparently tasted all these different herbs, you know, a little bit at a time, even the toxic ones, and came up with our first pharmacopoeia. That is such a shamanic thing. When you talk to the shamans who do ayahuasca in the jungle in Peru, they go in the jungle, the traditional ones will go in the jungle and start talking to the plant. And the plant will tell them how to cook it, how to mix it, what to include in it, how to work with it. So they learn directly from nature in a very shamanic kind of way. So Chinese medicine, I think, started out that way. Part of my training with Grandmaster Xi, were how I learned Chinese medicine is I meditated on all the points, all the combination of points, all the channels. So I had a very visceral sense of how the energy moves through the body. I had, you know, a very personal experience of that. And then eventually I went to acupuncture school and learned it more formally. But when I was in China, we were all Qigong students. We're telling Chinese people about energetics because for them, they learned it as a more intellectual system. So it's still practiced very much that way. Some of them didn't even believe in Qi, even though that's what they work with all day long. They just have a more theoretical, intellectual knowledge of that. And even in America, some schools are like that. If you have somebody who's a little bit more old-fashioned, they're really engaging that energetic aspect. So the shamanic is off brochure. It's something that if people have a need, they can find me. They typically do. But it's not something I want to do full time because it's just scheduling wise, it's a little bit more challenging. You know, the typical session's about an hour and a half. And we can get into longer time, depends on what we find. I find people are remarkably open to it, probably more so than what I'm comfortable discussing a lot of the time. I find that people, once you start talking about it, they start nodding, and you can tell that it's really sinking in, and you know it really evolves very naturally. But what I think the shamanic work gave me to Chinese medicine is just really an expansion of some of the concepts.
Yeah, thank you. Sturgis has a question.
Acupuncture I have done in the past, and it helped me to relax a lot, but I developed some food poisoning. Actually, I had shigella, and that really threw me off a loop in terms of pain, not sleeping, missing work. And the most important thing was energy. Like, I just want to be in bed all day long. I've been seeing Dr. Lund for maybe I had 5 sessions, maybe 6. I don't remember. And I don't say it's the acupuncture, but I feel my energy is coming back slowly in some way, in some capacity. And I'm not in pain anymore. And I don't know, I guess, what's happening. What I know is the presence. And when I mean the presence is, I feel when I go to the office, I feel safe. No matter what would happen there. And I want to thank you for that. Because to me, presence of being included, or knowing that I will close my eyes and I don't have to worry about anything. I will let go of everything. It's more powerful than anything else. So whether healing for me takes place in that setup of really letting go and know what is happening is for my own greater good, it's healing itself, like almost like a placebo effect. And I don't know a lot of acupuncture to say what's going on. And sometimes I question, I thought, how is that little needle goes to my fat, inside my fat, like not even very little. And what that do? Come on, that's like mumbo jumbo stuff, right? But I think because what's happening within me and the connection, I think I have built enough connection very quickly too with Dr. Lanford. And I don't know how to describe that other than trust, attunement. And I think attunement is big. It happened very quickly with not much talking, actually very little talking. And I cannot pinpoint what helps, what doesn't help. But I do know the presence and the letting go of. And I'm a Reiki practitioner, and I believe in energy. I believe in healing. And a lot of it has to abandon myself in the process, whatever that comes from. And to me, that's healing. So that's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
I'd like to talk a little bit about placebo because we've mentioned it a few times on this call. For me, placebo is an amazing thing because it's your own innate ability to heal. So when we're testing something against placebo, we're just basically testing something against your own body's ability to heal. So I don't know how placebo got its bad rep in medicine, or you know, why it's considered a lesser form of healing. I think it's the higher form of healing because it's really something that's not going to harm you, that actually allows you to shift your health to a better place. So placebo for me is like, when people say, oh, it's placebo, it's like, oh, that's great. That's a beautiful right. thing because that's your own body's ability to heal. And the abandonment, what you mentioned, Sturgis, is there needs to be permission. There needs to be space to heal. So when people came in, I remember one physician years ago, he was a psychiatrist, not a slight to the profession, but you just, you know, we go through the whole intake and then he leans in and he said, I don't believe a thing you're saying. and I knew I couldn't help him. There's no access, you know, there's nowhere to go. And I said, I really can't help you. And he said, I want you to try anyway. I said, I don't want to. And he kept, you know, and we did. And of course it didn't work, but you know, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If there's no access, if there's no invitation to heal, it is very, very, very difficult to get in. So that ability to relax, that ability to just really allow you to be present to the experience is part of the healing. Unfortunately, not something that we're talking to medical students about or physicians about. I mean, really, the last time I spoke to medical students years ago, I would say, you know, the problem with our profession is that you're learning all these things and you don't even have to do your own healing work. You know, so you're going to bring your whole, whatever your life's baggage is to the equation of, you know, healer and person needing healing. But, you know, unfortunately, that kind of was a little bit of a over their heads. And then I knew there was nothing else I could teach the medical students. I mean, it was just really, their questions were about reimbursement. They're in second year medical students. They're asking me about, is this reimbursable? I was like, we're talking about philosophy. We're talking about healing, about all these concepts. So the allowance, you know, the allowing yourself the experience to receive and be in that receptive place is a place where you're receiving from the universe. It's not just me. It's really, you're in the connecting with a greater field of healing. Those are really important things. So placebo, yay.
I agree with you. Betty?
I have a question and now I have a comment as well. So in my own experience as a receiver of healing, what I do, I'm very, very, very in touch with my body and I listen and it responds to whoever I'm with and whatever they're doing. And I know whether, yeah, that's right. Yeah, no, that's not. I'll do this. I won't do that. And what impressed me so much about the very first time that I worked with a practitioner, an acupuncture practitioner, was the intense listening that the person did to my pulses, the various pulses. And that is so key in this kind of work, that ability to listen and to connect with the other person. And I think that's so key in terms of the communication and the healing. And I respond very well to that. That's the comment that I wanted to make. And the question I have is, you had mentioned sacred drama. And I was wondering if you could speak a little more about what you mean by sacred drama and how you work with that and what results you see from that.
So basically, sacred drama, you will take elements of a healing session. And then if you have a group of people, then you can actually have assignments of, okay, you're going to be this person, you're going to be that person, you're going to be this particular element of the journey. And then we try to enact it as much as, you know, let's say we did a soul retrieval. So we went into the lower world, we explored, we went into the chamber of wounds, we went into the your contracts, your gifts, your, you know, the different parts that we kind of play with it. And then when we bring all that back, or whoever brought it back, you know, now we will start having people jump into those roles. So you have to energetically almost embody that particular object or that particular role. And then you have these conversations in between. So I don't tend to do it very often. I used to do it as part of the soul retrieval and then have the people kind of jump into those energetic places and then jump back into the, who they are. So it requires a little bit of back and forth energetically. You know, what led me to the shamanic path is, you know, when somebody in my first ever shamanic course, you know, we all did soul retrievals and then we did sacred drama to reenact them to kind of see if we could get a little bit more out of it. So somebody brought me a little box with a light in it, and we were using props because we were just having a lot of fun with it. So somebody put a flashlight in the little box for me, and I sat on the floor and I took the box and I just sat with it and I just kind of went into it. And what happened with that was one of the most transforming experiences of my life is my crown just blew completely open. And then this shower of light kind of rained through, illuminated my entire innards. And it lasted for weeks. And I couldn't stop laughing for days. And it was just such a joyful thing. But the insights and the energetic shifts that come from that. And I've had other things, or I call them downloads, you know, basically messages, spiritual messages coming through also during, you know, sacred drama, where you just kind of connect with that element, and just that interaction with the different people that are part of that experience help you to connect to the meaning or maybe a different insights. I don't tend to do it as part of my practice because it's just a little bit involved and it takes a little bit of time, but I find it's a very, very powerful way to connect with a particular experience. But you have to be able to kind of just jump in and out. You have to kind of separate who you are versus, you know, what you're jumping into, and then make that back and forth. I found it to be, you know, as much as the first time I was kind of like not really into it, I was the last one to go through it. But from that experience on, I knew that, you know, there was no doubt in my mind that it could be an extremely valuable healing tool. Does that answer your question a little bit?
Yes, thank you. Feels a little bit like, I think it's called family constellation work. Are you familiar with that? Don,
not.
Okay. Yeah, there's a leader, and there it works with a group of people. You don't have to be related to the people. It's best if they're not related. But it's a very intuitive kind of experience where there is the person who's at the center of the constellation, and other people intuitively take on the role of certain family members. It's a way to actually heal ancestral wounds that have been inherited. So then there's a line of people where they take on kind of intuitively take on the essence of the ancestors. And it's really amazing because it works. And people who aren't normally that intuitive, I have no problem believing anything like that because I've worked in energy and et cetera. But I've seen people who didn't believe that they had any intuitive kind of sense work, because we all have that ability, I think, innately. So it kind of felt a little bit like that. I'm really curious about that. I would like to know more about what you do.
And one of the exercises that was part of our training is you would have to write your own eulogy. So we all wrote our own eulogy. And then during the last segment of our training, we do death rites. So you would be lying down on the ground, and then your group would be around you. And then you would assign them, who would you want there at your deathbed? This is my spouse, my friend, my parents, you know, whoever you want around there. You would go through the saying goodbye portion, and everybody would, even though they don't know these people, they would just jump into that role and just kind of role play with you, kind of what you were saying. And then at the end of that, when you've said all your goodbyes, you know, they would put a shroud over you, and then somebody would read your eulogy over you, and then they would do something else after that. We'd unwind the chakras and launch people. But even without doing that, that part was really extremely intense and I think very healing. So I got to do it with my own spouse, and I got to do it with her. So she already said our goodbyes, you know, years ahead. But those experiences, I think, are really, people kind of just surrender a little bit to the experience. It's a very, very powerful mover of energy. You know, it can be very, very healing.
Hi, this is Salima. I did a few of those family constellations, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago now. One aspect of it that was interesting was that the person who's in the center of the circle, who's having a constellation happen, actually picks the people. You don't know the people, but you pick people.
Right.
To take certain roles. And I think that's very interesting in itself. And then the people who get those roles find themselves actually very much in that role. You know, it all just comes down pouring in. Mm-hmm. And that's how the constellation happens. I thought it was a really exciting work. I really enjoyed it. Hard sometimes, but
very good. Very.
Yeah.
Bob, you had a comment?
Yes, I wanted to comment on the earlier comments about placebo. I spent a couple of years after I retired from my psychology position doing clinical pharmacology research with a good friend of mine who was the pharmacist behind the project. And whenever we would talk about some of the things that we were observing in the research subjects, I would always comment to him that it's placebo. And he would always fight back with me about whether it could be or not. And I began to just adopt an approach that said it's all placebo. And that would really tick him off in the beginning of my using that expression, it's all placebo. And then toward the end of the time we were working together, he would start saying himself, it's all placebo. And initially he would do that just to mock me a little bit. But toward the end of the time, he would say that and mean it. It's all placebo. I think that goes along with what you were saying, Don. I do have a question for you on a more personal level, experientially. I think it's safe to say that you've been talking about map. You've been all over the map. How has that been for you? Do you find that that's on an experiential level? Is that a self-directed experience? Is it a guided experience? Is it the mystical path? How do you find yourself at any particular spot on that map at any given moment?
I think the map is not a fixed map. I think there's some room for expansion depending on where you are in your life and what you're ready or open to receiving. So I always find that the map is evolving, it's expanding. There are some core elements that seem to be physical map, emotional map. I mean, some of those core components, you know, I think are familiar enough that they shift a little bit, but they're familiar enough that you can recognize them. But I find that when you get into like the more mystical part or more spiritual part or more of your inner work, that map has a lot of chambers, if you say. Notice that as I evolve as a human being, as a spiritual being, that I'm led to kind of different parts of that landscape. And then you become aware that there are some other things to explore. So I'm a big fan of wandering around the map and exploring and seeing what we can find. But I think it evolves along as you evolve as a human being. So I think if I were to do this when I was in my teens or 20s, I mean, the map was a particular thing, but I can see how over certain points in my life or over the decades, how certain experiences have shaped my perception and my openness or, you know, ability to receive some of these elements. But the elements, I think there's some element of download. I think there's some times where you're really maybe in a more receptive place or you're ready to receive those experiences and they come through. Or you can just go wander in your life and see what kind of trouble you get into, you know, what you can discover about yourself and what you can discover about people. But I think that's what makes the healing map fun. And it's really, I think, important for us to give ourselves permission to explore things we're not familiar with or we're not comfortable with, or to taboo things, or, you know, whatever things that kind of hold the walls on your map, to be able to be open to peeking over the corners or over the walls and see what's on the other side.
So maybe sometimes we stand still and the map moves.
Sometimes. I think there's times where you're stuck and nothing is moving, and then all of a sudden something shifts. It's not that you necessarily provoked it, but maybe that was sometimes out of stuck, a lot of good things happen, or everything is chaotic. You know, chaos is a place of creation. So sometimes that friction, you need friction in life to make things happen. So sometimes it's not always the most pleasant things, like this whole COVID mess. There's an immense amount of friction happening, and I'm hoping something good comes out of it. But sometimes it's not so much what we're doing, but who we are interacting with the universe, and the universe kind of shifts and carries you with it. I think it's a little bit of give and take. I agree.
Sturgis also had a comment about another modality, internal family systems, that's akin to family constellation. I was thinking of psychodrama. And that, in the conversations we've had, the catchphrase in medicine these days is evidence-based. Mm-hmm. So I tweak my internist when I go to see him because he looked at me seriously and he said, I do try to stay evidence-based. And I said, okay. And I know the supplements I take you think aren't helping me, but I haven't been sick for 2 years. And he just looks at me and says, well, okay, it's not hurting you, so you can continue. The issue that I think we're revolving around is you and I and a lot of the people on the call here are somewhat comfortable with integration, synthesis, exploring, putting it together in a way that makes personal sense. In medicine right now, that's a no-no. It has to be one way. It has to be evidence-based. And the reason given has some truth to it, which is part of the responsibility of the medical establishment. And this goes for religions too, including spirituality without religions, is the thought that they're somehow more knowledgeable about what works and what is quackery, what just doesn't have any validity to it at all. And I think there's some truth to that, because I do think there's a lot of charlatanism out there. There are spiritual teachers who don't have spiritual capacity, or they have spiritual capacity, but they don't have much development. There are allopathic practitioners who don't do a very good job with allopathic medicine. And there's some stuff out there that's just dangerous because it does damage, or it says it'll do good, but it doesn't do anything. On the other hand, I'm beginning to think it's also a way of controlling. It's a mechanism of control, that if you don't follow these procedures and the changes don't come in a way that's comfortable and not chaotic, then it can't, we're not going to allow that. And I wonder, in your closing comments, because I think we've been talking about that, what are your thoughts about, how do you tell the wheat from the chaff and the things that have absolutely no validity, or the danger of integrating when you don't quite know what you're doing versus is it just a mechanism for control?
At this particular stage of our society, we've replaced religion with science. Science says, you know, it's a, I see the same issues with science that we've seen with organized religion, you know, in terms of the control part and who gets to decide what truth is. And, you know, it cannot be just what we observe, which was what is evidence-based. What about your own experience of what is going on in your life? We're discounting personal experience. So it's like, well, this works for me. This is a great thing. And then your doctor's looking at you like, well, that's bogus or that doesn't work. So who gets to decide? You know, and I think in our world of artificial intelligence, really coming to a place where with media censorship and those kind of things, it's just who gets to decide what is accurate? And medicine only know, and science only knows what it knows. Again, that little piece here in the rest of the room, you know, we only know what we know. And you know this as a physician, you know, the protocols are good until we find another protocol that replaces it because now we found something else. So what we thought was a truth before is no longer the truth and it's changeable. So evidence-based is like, yeah, to some extent, but it cannot be the only criteria that we judge healing and medicine and science. I mean, it has to be experiential as well as observational because it cannot just be about what we see. The unseen is so much more vast than what we see in this world, and there's much to be explored. I mean, that hidden landscape, that unseen portion of who we are as human beings, as spiritual beings, if we're not going to engage our spirituality, which is probably the most potent way of accessing healing and medicine, we're always going to be chasing our tails. So I think that evidence thing, it just rubs me the wrong way. It's just, you know, it's just overdone, over trusted. And I think, you know, we have to be very careful who gets to decide what truth is and what facts are true. And then we're seeing this as a society is like, we can't trust anything. So ultimately you're going to have to start thinking for yourself and decide, this is okay for me, this is not okay for me. And, you know, I think we're going to be battling, you know, personal sovereignty issues in medicine and informed consent and right to consent for certain things. I think that's all coming to a head in the next year. So I think we're up against these big major shifts in society because we've replaced religion with science, and we're going to see, you know, not so good things being done with that. So not a positive way to end the call, but I think we all have to be aware of that, that I think all these issues are going to be coming up, and they need to come up. I think that's a healthy something.
As a closing note, it's not just about medicine. I mean, I'm finding this in spiritual groups and religions, and I think we're onto something. And I find the way you're describing it as very empowering of the individual and of the practitioner. If you're not practicing what you believe, that vibration is going to get out. It's going to affect the people you're with. And Sturgis put it so well, he had to leave the call. He felt like he could let go with you. I felt that way. Just the presence of the relationship in itself is healing and allows something to happen. And that has to be respected. And psychiatrists have talked this way for as long as I've been working as a psychiatrist. Whether we practice what we preach is another story. So Don, I hope you're willing to come back at another time and continue conversations. For those of you that are local to Rochester, you know where to find him.
If you find yourself enjoying our podcasts, please do us a favor and spread the word. Tell a friend about it. Give us a review on iTunes or post it on social media. If you or someone you know would like to participate in a future podcast, please connect with us through the Contact Us page. See our events calendar page for dates to our next live podcast recordings. We'd love for you to participate and ask questions. And be sure to check out Joel Lessie's podcast, Unraveling Religion, on your favorite podcast app. Alchemical Dialogues are live and unscripted conversations recorded on Zoom, brought to you by the great folks of Amber Light International, a nonprofit organization co-founded by Henry Curtella, MD, and Kathleen Fitzpatrick, LCSW. We choose topics from our current social and cultural climate with an emphasis on humanism and spirituality.